sets out from the idea of totality, although its proper and final aim is the unconditioned, of the whole series or of a part thereof. This unconditioned may be cogitated, either as existing only in the entire series, all the members of which therefore would be without exception conditioned, and only the totality absolutely unconditioned, and in this case the regressus is called infinite, or the absolutely unconditioned is only a part of the series, to which the other members are subordinated, but which is not itself submitted to any other condition. See footnote. In the former case, the series is a parte priori unlimited, without beginning, that is, infinite, and nevertheless completely given. But the regress in it is never completed, and can only be called potentially infinite. In the second case, there exists a first in the series. This first is called, in relation to past time, the beginning of the world. In relation to space, the limit of the world. In relation to the parts of a given limited whole, the simple. In relation to causes, absolute spontaneity, liberty. And in relation to the existence of changeable things, absolute physical necessity. Footnote. The absolute totality of the series of conditions to a given conditioned is always unconditioned, because beyond it there exists no other conditions on which it might depend. But the absolute totality of such a series is only an idea, or rather, a problematical conception, the possibility of which must be investigated, particularly in relation to the mode in which the unconditioned, as the transcendental idea which is the real subject of inquiry, may be contained therein. We possess two expressions, world and nature, which are generally interchanged. The first denotes the mathematical total of all phenomena and the totality of their synthesis, in its progress by means of composition as well as by division. And the world is termed nature, see footnote, when it is regarded as a dynamical whole, when our attention is not directed to the aggregation in space and time for the purpose of cogitating it as a quantity, but to the unity in the existence of phenomena. In this case, the condition of that which happens is called a cause. The unconditioned causality of the cause in a phenomenon is termed liberty. The conditioned cause is called, in a more limited sense, a natural cause. The conditioned in existence is termed contingent, and the unconditioned necessary. The unconditioned necessity of phenomena may be called natural necessity. Footnote. Nature, understood adjective, formaliter, signifies the complex of the determinations of a thing connected according to an internal principle of causality. On the other hand, we understand by nature substantive, materialiter, the sum total of phenomena, in so far as they, by virtue of an internal principle of causality, are connected with each other throughout. In the former sense, we speak of the nature of liquid matter, of fire, etc., and employ the word only adjective. While, if speaking of the objects of nature, we have in our minds the idea of a subsisting whole. The ideas which we are at present engaged in discussing I have called cosmological ideas, partly because by the term world is understood the entire content of all phenomena, and our ideas are directed solely to the unconditioned among phenomena. Partly also because world, in the transcendental sense, signifies the absolute totality of the content of existing things, and we are directing our attention only to the completeness of the synthesis, although properly only in regression. In regard to the fact that these ideas are all transcendent, and although they do not transcend phenomena as regards their mode, but are concerned solely with the world of sense, and not with noumena, nevertheless carry their synthesis to a degree far above all possible experience, it still seems to me that we can with perfect propriety designate them cosmical conceptions. As regards the distinction between the mathematically and the dynamically unconditioned, which is the aim of the regression of the synthesis, I should call the two former, in a more limited signification, cosmical conceptions, the remaining two transcendent physical conceptions. This distinction does not at present seem to be of particular importance, but we shall afterwards find it to be of some value. Section 2. Antithetic of pure reason. Thetic is the term applied to every collection of dogmatical propositions. By antithetic, I do not understand dogmatical assertions of the opposite, but the self-contradiction of seemingly dogmatical cognitions, thesis cum antithesi, in none of which we can discover any decided superiority. Antithetic is not therefore occupied with one-sided statements, but is engaged in considering the contradictory nature of the general cognitions of reason and its causes. Transcendental antithetic is an investigation into the antinomy of pure reason, its causes and result. If we employ our reason not merely in the application of the principles of the understanding to objects of experience, but venture with it beyond these boundaries, there arise certain sophistical propositions or theorems. These assertions have the following peculiarities. They can find neither confirmation nor confutation in experience, and each is in itself not only self-consistent, but possesses conditions of its necessity in the very nature of reason. Only that, unluckily, there exist just as valid and necessary grounds for maintaining the contrary proposition. The questions which naturally arise in the consideration of this dialectic of pure reason are therefore, first, in what propositions is pure reason unavoidably subject to an antinomy? Second, what are the causes of this antinomy? Third, whether and in what way can reason free itself from this self-contradiction? A dialectical proposition or theorem of pure reason must, according to what has been said, be distinguishable from all sophistical propositions by the fact that it is not an answer to an arbitrary question which may be raised at the mere pleasure of any person, but to one which human reason must necessarily encounter in its progress. In the second place, a dialectical proposition with its opposite does not carry the appearance of a merely artificial illusion which disappears as soon as it is investigated, but a natural and unavoidable illusion, which, even when we are no longer deceived by it, continues to mock us, and although rendered harmless, can never be completely removed. This dialectical doctrine will not relate to the unity of understanding in empirical conceptions, but to the unity of reason in pure ideas. The conditions of this doctrine are, inasmuch as it must, as a synthesis according to rules, be conformable to the understanding, and at the same time as the absolute unity of the synthesis to the reason, that, if it is adequate to the unity of reason, it is too great for the understanding. If, according with the understanding, it is too small for the reason. Hence arises a mutual opposition which cannot be avoided, do what we will. These sophistical assertions of dialectic open, as it were, a battlefield where that side obtains the victory which has been permitted to make the attack, and he is compelled to yield who has been unfortunately obliged to stand on the defensive. And hence, champions of ability, whether on the right or on the wrong side, are certain to carry away the crown of victory, if they only take care to have the right to make the last attack, and are not obliged to sustain another onset from their opponent. We can easily believe that this arena has been often trampled by the feet of combatants, that many victories have been obtained on both sides, but that the last victory, decisive of the affair between the contending parties, was won by him who fought for the right, only if his adversary was forbidden to continue the tourney. As impartial umpires, we must lay aside entirely the consideration whether the combatants are fighting for the right or for the wrong side, for the true or for the false, and allow the combat to be first decided. Perhaps, after they have wearied more than injured each other, they will discover the nothingness of their cause of quarrel and part good friends. This method of watching, or rather of originating a conflict of assertions, not for the purpose of finally deciding in favour of either side, but to discover whether the object of the struggle is not a mere illusion, which each strives in vain to reach, but which would be no gain even when reached, this procedure, I say, may be termed the skeptical method. It is thoroughly distinct from skepticism, the principle of a technical and scientific ignorance which undermines the foundations of all knowledge in order, if possible, to destroy our belief and confidence therein. For the skeptical method aims at certainty by endeavouring to discover in a conflict of this kind, conducted honestly and intelligently on both sides, the point of misunderstanding. just as wise legislators derive, from the embarrassment of judges in lawsuits, information in regard to the defective and ill-defined parts of their statutes. The antinomy which reveals itself in the application of laws is, for our limited wisdom, the best criterion of legislation. For the attention of reason, which in abstract speculation does not easily become conscious of its errors, is thus roused to the momenta in the determination of its principles. But this sceptical method is essentially peculiar to transcendental philosophy, and can perhaps be dispensed with in every other field of investigation. In mathematics, its use would be absurd, because in it no false assertions can long remain hidden, inasmuch as its demonstrations must always proceed under the guidance of pure intuition, and by means of an always evident synthesis. In experimental philosophy, doubt and delay may be very useful, but no misunderstanding is possible which cannot be easily removed, and in experience, means of solving the difficulty and putting an end to the dissension must at last be found, whether sooner or later. Moral philosophies can always exhibit its principles, with their practical consequences in concreto, at least in possible experiences, and thus escape the mistakes and ambiguities of abstraction. But transcendental propositions, which lay claim to insight beyond the region of possible experience, cannot, on the one hand, exhibit their abstract synthesis in any a priori intuition, nor, on the other, expose a lurking error by the help of experience. Transcendental reason, therefore, presents us with no other criterion than that of an attempt to reconcile such assertions, and for this purpose to permit a free and unrestrained conflict between them. And this we now proceed to arrange. See footnote. Footnote. The antinomies stand in the order of the four transcendental ideas above detailed. First conflict of the transcendental ideas. Thesis. The world has a beginning in time and is also limited in regard to space. Proof. Granted that the world has no beginning in time, up to every given moment of time, an eternity must have elapsed, and therewith passed away an infinite series of successive conditions or states of things in the world. Now the infinity of a series consists in the fact that it never can be completed by means of a successive synthesis. It follows that an infinite series already elapsed is impossible, and that consequently a beginning of the world is a necessary condition of its existence. And this was the first thing to be proved. As regards the second, let us take the opposite for granted. In this case, the world must be an infinite given total of coexistent things. Now, we cannot cogitate the dimensions of a quantity, which is not given within certain limits of an intuition, see footnote, in any other way than by means of the synthesis of its parts, and the total of such a quantity only by means of a completed synthesis, or the repeated addition of unity to itself. Accordingly, to cogitate the world which fills all spaces as a whole, the successive synthesis of the parts of an infinite world must be looked upon as completed, that is to say, an infinite time must be regarded as having elapsed in the enumeration of all coexisting things, which is impossible. For this reason, an infinite aggregate of actual things cannot be considered as a given whole, consequently not as a contemporaneously given whole. The world is, consequently, as regards extension in space, not infinite, but enclosed in limits. And this was the second thing to be proved. Footnote. We may consider an undetermined quantity as a whole when it is enclosed within limits, although we cannot construct or ascertain its totality by measurement, that is, by the successive synthesis of its parts. For its limits of themselves determine its completeness as a whole. Antithesis. The world has no beginning and no limits in space, but is, in relation both to time and space, infinite. Proof. For let it be granted that it has a beginning. A beginning is an existence which is preceded by a time in which the thing does not exist. On the above supposition, it follows that there must have been a time in which the world did not exist, that is, a void time. But in a void time, the origination of a thing is impossible. because no part of any such time contains a distinctive condition of being in preference to that of non-being, whether the supposed thing originate of itself or by means of some other cause. Consequently, many series of things may have a beginning in the world, but the world itself cannot have a beginning, and is therefore, in relation to past time, infinite. As regards the second statement, let us first take the opposite for granted, that the world is finite and limited in space. It follows that it must exist in a void space which is not limited. We should therefore meet not only with the relation of things in space, but also a relation of things to space. Now, as the world is an absolute whole, out of and beyond which no object of intuition, and consequently no correlate to which can be discovered, this relation of the world to a void space is merely a relation to no object. But such a relation, and consequently the limitation of the world by void space, is nothing. Consequently, the world, as regards space, is not limited, that is, it is infinite in regard to extension. See footnote. Footnote. Space is merely the form of external intuition, formal intuition, and not a real object which can be externally perceived. Space, prior to all things which determine it, fill or limit it, or rather which present an empirical intuition conformable to it, is, under the title of absolute space, nothing but the mere possibility of external phenomena, insofar as they exist in themselves or can annex themselves to given intuitions. Empirical intuition is therefore not a composition of phenomena and space, of perception and empty intuition. The one is not the correlate of the other in a synthesis, but they are vitally connected in the same empirical intuition as matter and form. If we wish to set one of these two apart from the other, space and phenomena, there arise all sorts of empty determinations of external intuitions, which are very far from being possible perceptions. For example, motion or rest of the world in an infinite empty space, or a determination of the mutual relation of both, cannot possibly be perceived, and is therefore merely the predicate of a notional entity. Observations on the first antinomy. On the thesis. In bringing forward these conflicting arguments, I have not been on the search for sophisms for the purpose of availing myself of special pleading which takes advantage of the carelessness of the opposite party, appeals to a misunderstood statute, and erects its unrighteous claims upon an unfair interpretation. Both proofs originate fairly from the nature of the case, and the advantage presented by the mistakes of the dogmatists of both parties have been completely set aside. The thesis might also have been unfairly demonstrated by the introduction of an erroneous conception of the infinity of a given quantity. A quantity is infinite if a greater than itself cannot possibly exist. The quantity is measured by the number of given units, which are taken as a standard, contained in it. Now, no number can be the greatest because one or more units can always be added. It follows that an infinite given quantity, consequently an infinite world, both as regards time and extension, is impossible. It is, therefore, limited in both respects. In this manner, I might have conducted my proof, but the conception given in it does not agree with the true conception of an infinite whole. In this, there is no representation of its quantity. It is not said how large it is. Consequently, its conception is not the conception of a maximum. We cogitate in it merely its relation to an arbitrarily assumed unit, in relation to which it is greater than any number. Now, just as the unit which is taken is greater or smaller, the infinite will be greater or smaller. But the infinity, which consists merely in the relation to this given unit, must remain always the same, although the absolute quantity of the whole is not thereby cognized. The true transcendental conception of infinity is that the successive synthesis of unity in the measurement of a given quantum can never be completed. See footnote. Hence it follows without possibility of mistake that an eternity of actual successive states up to a given, the present, moment cannot have elapsed, and that the world must therefore have a beginning. Footnote. The quantum in this sense contains a congeries of given units, which is greater than any number. and this is the mathematical conception of the infinite. In regard to the second part of the thesis, the difficulty as to an infinite and yet elapsed series disappears, for the manifold of a world infinite in extension is contemporaneously given. But in order to cogitate the total of this manifold, as we cannot have the aid of limits constituting by themselves this total in intuition, we are obliged to give some account of our conception, which in this case cannot proceed from the whole to the determined quantity of the parts, but must demonstrate the possibility of a whole by means of a successive synthesis of the parts. But as this synthesis must constitute a series that cannot be completed, it is impossible for us to cogitate prior to it, and consequently not by means of it, a totality. For the conception of totality itself is in the present case the representation of a completed synthesis of the parts, and this completion, and consequently its conception, is impossible. On the antithesis. The proof in favour of the infinity of the cosmical succession and the cosmical content is based upon the consideration that, in the opposite case, a void time and a void space must constitute the limits of the world. Now, I am not unaware that there are some ways of escaping this conclusion. It may, for example, be alleged that a limit to the world, as regards both space and time, is quite possible without at the same time holding the existence of an absolute time before the beginning of the world, or an absolute space extending beyond the actual world, which is impossible. I am quite well satisfied with the latter part of this opinion of the philosophers of the Leibnizian school. Space is merely the form of external intuition, but not a real object which can itself be externally intuited. It is not a correlate of phenomena, it is the form of phenomena itself. Space, therefore, cannot be regarded as absolutely and in itself something determinative of the existence of things, because it is not itself an object, but only the form of possible objects. Consequently, things, as phenomena, determine space. That is to say, they render it possible that, of all the possible predicates of space, size and relation, certain may belong to reality. But we cannot affirm the converse, that space, as something self-subsistent, can determine real things in regard to size or shape, for it is in itself not a real thing. Space, filled or void, see footnote, may therefore be limited by phenomena. But phenomena cannot be limited by an empty space without them. This is true of time also. All this being granted, it is nevertheless indisputable that we must assume these two non-entities, void space without and void time before the world, if we assume the existence of cosmical limits relatively to space or time. Footnote. It is evident that what is meant here is that empty space, in so far as it is limited by phenomena, space that is within the world, does not at least contradict transcendental principles, and may therefore, as regards them, be admitted, although its possibility cannot on that account be affirmed. For, as regards the subterfuge adopted by those who would endeavour to evade the consequence, that if the world is limited as to space and time, the infinite void must determine the existence of actual things in regard to their dimensions, it arises solely from the fact that, instead of a sensuous world, an intelligible world, of which nothing is known, is cogitated. Instead of a real beginning, an existence which is preceded by a period in which nothing exists, an existence which presupposes no other condition than that of time, and instead of limits of extension, boundaries of the universe. But the question relates to mundus phenomenon and its quantity, and in this case we cannot make abstraction of the conditions of sensibility without doing away with the essential reality of this world itself. The world of sense, if it is limited, must necessarily lie in the infinite void. If this, and with it space as the a priori condition of the possibility of phenomena, is left out of view, the whole world of sense disappears. In our problem is this alone considered as given. The mundus intelligibilis is nothing but the general conception of a world in which abstraction has been made of all conditions of intuition, and in relation to which no synthetical proposition, either affirmative or negative, is possible. Second conflict of the transcendental ideas. Thesis. Every composite substance in the world consists of simple parts, and there exists nothing that is not either itself simple or composed of simple parts. Proof. For, grant that composite substances do not consist of simple parts, in this case, if all combination or composition were annihilated in thought, no composite part, and, as by the supposition there do not exist simple parts, no simple part would exist. Consequently, no substance. Consequently, nothing would exist. Either, then, it is impossible to annihilate composition in thought, or, after such annihilation, there must remain something that subsists without composition, that is, something that is simple. But in the former case, the composite could not itself consist of substances, because with substances, composition is merely a contingent relation, apart from which they must still exist as self-subsistent beings. Now, as this case contradicts the supposition, the second must contain the truth, that the substantial composite in the world consists of simple parts. It follows as an immediate inference that the things in the world are all, without exception, simple beings, that composition is merely an external condition pertaining to them, and that, although we can never separate and isolate the elementary substances from the state of composition, reason must cogitate these as the primary subjects of all composition, and consequently as prior thereto, and as simple substances. Antithesis. No composite thing in the world consists of simple parts, and there does not exist in the world any simple substance. Proof. Let it be supposed that a composite thing, as substance, consists of simple parts. Inasmuch as all external relation, consequently all composition of substances, is possible only in space, the space occupied by that which is composite must consist of the same number of parts as is contained in the composite. But space does not consist of simple parts, but of spaces. Therefore, every part of the composite must occupy a space. But the absolutely primary parts of what is composite are simple. It follows that what is simple occupies a space. Now, as everything real that occupies a space contains a manifold, the parts of which are external to each other, and is consequently composite, and a real composite not of accidents, for these cannot exist to each other apart from substance, but of substances, it follows that the simple must be a substantial composite, which is self-contradictory. The second proposition of the antithesis, that there exists in the world nothing that is simple, is here equivalent to the following. The existence of the absolutely simple cannot be demonstrated from any experience or perception, either external or internal, and the absolutely simple is a mere idea, the objective reality of which cannot be demonstrated in any possible experience. It is, consequently, in the exposition of phenomena without application and object. For let us take for granted that an object may be found in experience for this transcendental idea. The empirical intuition of such an object must then be recognized to contain absolutely no manifold with its parts external to each other and connected into unity. Now, as we cannot reason from the non-consciousness of such a manifold to the impossibility of its existence in the intuition of an object, and as the proof of this impossibility is necessary for the establishment and proof of absolute simplicity, it follows that this simplicity cannot be inferred from any perception whatever. As, therefore, an absolutely simple object cannot be given in any experience, and the world of sense must be considered as the sum total of all possible experiences, nothing simple exists in the world. This second proposition in the antithesis has a more extended aim than the first. The first merely banishes the simple from the intuition of the composite, while the second drives it entirely out of nature. Hence, we were unable to demonstrate it from the conception of a given object of external intuition, of the composite, but we were obliged to prove it from the relation of a given object to a possible experience in general. Observations on the second antinomy. Thesis. When I speak of a whole, which necessarily consists of simple parts, I understand thereby only a substantial whole as the true composite. That is to say, I understand that contingent unity of the manifold which is given as perfectly isolated, at least in thought, placed in reciprocal connection, and thus constituted a unity. Space ought not to be called a compositum, but a totem, for its parts are possible in the whole, and not the whole by means of the parts. It might perhaps be called a compositum ideale, but not a compositum reale. But this is of no importance. As space is not a composite of substances, and not even of real accidents, if I abstract all composition therein, nothing, not even a point, remains. For a point is possible only as the limit of a space, consequently of a composite. Space and time, therefore, do not consist of simple parts. That which belongs only to the condition or state of a substance, even although it possesses a quantity, motion or change, for example, likewise does not consist of simple parts. That is to say, a certain degree of change does not originate from the addition of many simple changes. Our inference of the simple from the composite is valid only of self-subsisting things. But the accidents of a state are not self-subsistent. The proof, then, for the necessity of the simple as the component part of all that is substantial and composite may prove a failure, and the whole case of this thesis be lost if we carry the proposition too far and wish to make it valid of everything that is composite without distinction, as indeed has really now and then happened. Besides, I am here speaking only of the simple, in so far as it is necessarily given in the composite, the latter being capable of solution into the former as its component parts. The proper signification of the word monas, as employed by Leibniz, ought to relate to the simple given immediately as simple substance, for example in consciousness, and not as an element of the composite. As an element, the term atomus would be more appropriate. And as I wish to prove the existence of simple substances only in relation to and as the elements of the composite, I might term the antithesis of the second antinomy transcendental atomistic. But as this word has long been employed to designate a particular theory of corporeal phenomena, moleculae, and thus presupposes a basis of empirical conceptions, I prefer calling it the dialectical principle of monadology. Antithesis. Against the assertion of the infinite subdivisibility of matter, whose ground of proof is purely mathematical, objections have been alleged by the monadists. These objections lay themselves open at first sight to suspicion from the fact that they do not recognize the clearest mathematical proofs as propositions relating to the constitution of space, in so far as it is really the formal condition of the possibility of all matter, but regard them merely as inferences from abstract but arbitrary conceptions, which cannot have any application to real things. Just as if it were possible to imagine another mode of intuition than that given in the primitive intuition of space, and just as if its a priori determinations did not apply to everything, the existence of which is possible from the fact alone of its filling space. If we listen to them, we shall find ourselves required to cogitate in addition to the mathematical point, which is simple, not, however, a part, but a mere limit of space, physical points, which are indeed likewise simple, but possess the peculiar property, as parts of space, of filling it merely by their aggregation. I shall not repeat here the common and clear refutations of this absurdity, which are to be found everywhere in numbers. Everyone knows that it is impossible to undermine the evidence of mathematics by mere discursive conceptions. I shall only remark that, if in this case philosophy endeavours to gain an advantage over mathematics by sophistical artifices, it is because it forgets that the discussion relates solely to phenomena and their conditions. It is not sufficient to find the conception of the simple for the pure conception of the composite, but we must discover for the intuition of the composite, matter, the intuition of the simple. Now this, according to the laws of sensibility, and consequently in the case of objects of sense, is utterly impossible. In the case of a whole composed of substances, which is cogitated solely by the pure understanding, it may be necessary to be in possession of the simple before composition is possible. But this does not hold good of the totum substantiale phenomenon, which, as an empirical intuition in space, possesses the necessary property of containing no simple part, for the very reason that no part of space is simple. Meanwhile, the monadists have been subtle enough to escape from this difficulty by presupposing intuition and by the dynamical relation of substances as the condition of the possibility of space, instead of regarding space as the condition of the possibility of the objects of external intuition, that is, of bodies. Now we have a conception of bodies only as phenomena, and as such, they necessarily presuppose space as the condition of all external phenomena. The evasion is therefore in vain, as indeed we have sufficiently shown in our aesthetic. If bodies were things in themselves, the proof of the monadists would be unexceptionable. The second dialectical assertion possesses the peculiarity of having opposed to it a dogmatical proposition, which, among all such sophistical statements, is the only one that undertakes to prove in the case of an object of experience that which is properly a transcendental idea, the absolute simplicity of substance. The proposition is that the object of the internal sense, the thinking ego, is an absolute simple substance. Without at present entering upon this subject, as it has been considered at length in a former chapter, I shall merely remark that if something is cogitated merely as an object without the addition of any synthetical determination of its intuition, as happens in the case of the bare representation I, it is certain that no manifold and no composition can be perceived in such a representation. As, moreover, the predicates whereby I cogitate this object are merely intuitions of the internal sense, there cannot be discovered in them anything to prove the existence of a manifold whose parts are external to each other, and consequently nothing to prove the existence of real composition. Consciousness, therefore, is so constituted that, inasmuch as the thinking subject is at the same time its own object, it cannot divide itself, although it can divide its inhering determinations. For every object in relation to itself is absolute unity. Nevertheless, if the subject is regarded externally as an object of intuition, it must, in its character of phenomenon, possess the property of composition. And it must always be regarded in this manner if we wish to know whether there is or is not contained in it a manifold whose parts are external to each other. Third conflict of transcendental ideas. Thesis. Causality, according to the laws of nature, is not the only causality operating to originate the phenomena of the world. A causality of freedom is also necessary to account fully for these phenomena. Proof. Let it be supposed that there is no other kind of causality than that according to the laws of nature. Consequently, everything that happens presupposes a previous condition, which it follows with absolute certainty, in conformity with a rule. But this previous condition must itself be something that has happened, that has arisen in time, as it did not exist before. For, if it has always been in existence, its consequence or effect would not thus originate for the first time, but would likewise have always existed. The causality, therefore, of a cause, whereby something happens, is itself a thing that has happened. Now this, again, presupposes, in conformity with the law of nature, a previous condition and its causality, and this another anterior to the former, and so on. If, then, everything happens solely in accordance with the laws of nature, there cannot be any real first beginning of things, but only a subaltern or comparative beginning. There cannot, therefore, be a completeness of series on the side of the causes which originate the one from the other. But the law of nature is that nothing can happen without a sufficient a priori determined cause. The proposition, therefore, if all causality is possible only in accordance with the laws of nature, is, when stated in this unlimited and general manner, self-contradictory. It follows that this cannot be the only kind of causality. From what has been said, it follows that a causality must be admitted by means of which something happens without its cause being determined according to the necessary laws by some other cause preceding. That is to say, there must exist an absolute spontaneity of cause, which of itself originates a series of phenomena which proceeds according to natural laws. Consequently, transcendental freedom, without which, even in the course of nature, the succession of phenomena on the side of causes is never complete. Antithesis. There is no such thing as freedom, but everything in the world happens solely according to the laws of nature. Proof. Granted that there does exist freedom in the transcendental sense as a peculiar kind of causality operating to produce events in the world, a faculty, that is to say, of originating a state and consequently a series of consequences from that state. In this case, not only the series originated by this spontaneity, but the determination of this spontaneity itself to the production of the series, that is to say, the causality itself, must have an absolute commencement, such that nothing can proceed to determine this action according to unvarying laws. But every beginning of action presupposes in the acting cause a state of inaction, and a dynamically primal beginning of action presupposes a state which has no connection, as regards causality, with the preceding state of the cause, which does not, that is, in any wise result from it. Transcendental freedom is therefore opposed to the natural law of cause and effect, and such a conjunction of successive states in effective causes is destructive of the possibility of unity in experience, and for that reason not to be found in experience. Is consequently a mere fiction of thought. We have, therefore, nothing but nature to which we must look for connection and order in cosmical events. Freedom, independence of the laws of nature, is certainly a deliverance from restraint, but it is also a relinquishing of the guidance of law and rule. For it cannot be alleged that, instead of the laws of nature, laws of freedom may be introduced into the causality of the course of nature. For if freedom were determined according to laws, it would be no longer freedom, but merely nature. Nature, therefore, and transcendental freedom are distinguishable as conformity to law and lawlessness. The former imposes upon understanding the difficulty of seeking the origin of events ever higher and higher in the series of causes, inasmuch as causality is always conditioned thereby. While it compensates this labor by the guarantee of a unity complete and in conformity with law. The latter, on the contrary, holds out to the understanding the promise of a point of rest in the chain of causes by conducting it to an unconditioned causality, which professes to have the power of spontaneous origination, but which, in its own utter blindness, deprives it of the guidance of rules by which alone a completely connected experience is possible. Observations on the third antinomy. On the thesis. The transcendental idea of freedom is far from constituting the entire content of the psychological conception so termed, which is for the most part empirical. It merely presents us with the conception of spontaneity of action as the proper ground for imputing freedom to the cause of a certain class of objects. It is, however, the true stumbling stone to philosophy, which meets with unconquerable difficulties in the way of its admitting this kind of unconditioned causality. That element in the question of the freedom of the will, which has for so long a time placed speculative reason in such perplexity, is properly only transcendental, and concerns the question whether there must be held to exist a faculty of spontaneous origination of a series of successive things or states. How such a faculty is possible is not a necessary inquiry, for in the case of natural causality itself, we are obliged to content ourselves with the a priori knowledge that such a causality must be presupposed, although we are quite incapable of comprehending how the being of one thing is possible through the being of another, but must for this information look entirely to experience. Now we have demonstrated this necessity of a free first beginning of a series of phenomena only in so far as it is required for the comprehension of an origin of the world, all following states being regarded as a succession according to laws of nature alone. But as there has thus been proved the existence of a faculty which can of itself originate a series in time, although we are unable to explain how it can exist, we feel ourselves authorized to admit, even in the midst of the natural course of events, a beginning as regards causality of different successions of phenomena, and at the same time to attribute to all substances a faculty of free action. But we ought in this case not to allow ourselves to fall into a common misunderstanding, and to suppose that, because a successive series in the world can only have a comparatively first beginning, another state or condition of things always proceeding, an absolutely first beginning of a series in the course of nature is impossible. For we are not speaking here of an absolutely first beginning in relation to time, but as regards causality alone. When, for example, I completely, of my own free will and independently of the necessarily determinative influence of natural causes, rise from my chair, there commences with this event, including its material consequences in infinitum, an absolutely new series. Although, in relation to time, this event is merely the continuation of a preceding series. For this resolution and act of mine do not form part of the succession of effects in nature, and are not mere continuations of it. On the contrary, the determining causes of nature cease to operate in reference to this event, which certainly succeeds the acts of nature, but does not proceed from them. For these reasons, the action of a free agent must be termed, in regard to causality, if not in relation to time, an absolutely primal beginning of a series of phenomena. The justification of this need of reason to rest upon a free act as the first beginning of the series of natural causes is evident from the fact that all philosophers of antiquity, with the exception of the Epicurean school, felt themselves obliged, when constructing a theory of the motions of the universe, to accept a prime mover, that is, a freely acting cause, which spontaneously and prior to all other causes evolved this series of states. They always felt the need of going beyond mere nature for the purpose of making a first beginning comprehensible. On the antithesis, the assertor of the all-sufficiency of nature in regard to causality, transcendental physiocracy, in opposition to the doctrine of freedom, would defend his view of the question somewhat in the following manner. He would say, in answer to the sophistical arguments of the opposite party, "If you do not accept a mathematical first in relation to time, you have no need to seek a dynamical first in regard to causality. Who compelled you to imagine an absolutely primal condition of the world, and therewith an absolute beginning of the gradually progressing successions of phenomena, and, as some foundation for this fancy of yours, to set bounds to unlimited nature? Inasmuch as the substances in the world have always existed, at least the unity of experience renders such a supposition quite necessary, there is no difficulty in believing also that the changes in the conditions of these substances have always existed, and consequently that a first beginning, mathematical or dynamical, is by no means required. The possibility of such an infinite derivation without any initial member, from which all the others result, is certainly quite incomprehensible. But if you are rash enough to deny the enigmatical secrets of nature for this reason, you will find yourselves obliged to deny also the existence of many fundamental properties of natural objects, such as fundamental forces, which you can just as little comprehend. And even the possibility of so simple a conception as that of change must present to you insuperable difficulties. For if experience did not teach you that it was real, you never could conceive a priori the possibility of this ceaseless sequence of being and non-being. But if the existence of a transcendental faculty of freedom is granted, a faculty of originating changes in the world, this faculty must at least exist out of and apart from the world. Although it is certainly a bold assumption that, over and above the complete content of all possible intuitions, there still exists an object which cannot be presented in any possible perception. But to attribute to substances in the world itself such a faculty is quite inadmissible, for in this case the connection of phenomena reciprocally determining and determined according to general laws, which is termed nature, and along with it the criteria of empirical truth, which enable us to distinguish experience from mere visionary dreaming, would almost entirely disappear. In proximity with such a lawless faculty of freedom, a system of nature is hardly cogitable. For the laws of the latter would be continually subject to the intrusive influences of the former, and the course of the phenomena, which would otherwise proceed regularly and uniformly, would become thereby confused and disconnected. Fourth conflict of the transcendental ideas. Thesis. There exists either in or in connection with the world, either as a part of it or as the cause of it, an absolutely necessary being. Proof. The world of sense, as the sum total of all phenomena, contains a series of changes. For without such a series, the mental representation of the series of time itself, as the condition of the possibility of the sensuous world, could not be presented to us. See footnote. But every change stands under its condition, which precedes it in time and renders it necessary. Now, the existence of a given condition presupposes a complete series of conditions up to the absolutely unconditioned, which alone is absolutely necessary. It follows that something that is absolutely necessary must exist if change exists as its consequence. But this necessary thing itself belongs to the sensuous world. For suppose it to exist out of and apart from it, the series of cosmical changes would receive from it a beginning, and yet this necessary cause would not itself belong to the world of sense. But this is impossible. For, as the beginning of a series in time is determined only by that which precedes it in time, the supreme condition of the beginning of a series of changes must exist in the time in which this series itself did not exist. For a beginning supposes a time preceding, in which the thing that begins to be was not in existence. The causality of the necessary cause of changes, and consequently the cause itself, must for these reasons belong to time, and to phenomena, time being possible only as the form of phenomena. Consequently, it cannot be cogitated as separated from the world of sense, the sum total of all phenomena. There is, therefore, contained in the world something that is absolutely necessary, whether it be the whole cosmical series itself or only a part of it. Footnote. Objectively, time, as the formal condition of the possibility of change, precedes all changes. But, subjectively and in consciousness, the representation of time, like every other, is given solely by occasion of perception. Antithesis. An absolutely necessary being does not exist, either in the world or out of it, as its cause. Proof. Grant that either the world itself is necessary, or that there is contained in it a necessary existence. Two cases are possible. First, there must either be in the series of cosmical changes a beginning, which is unconditionally necessary and therefore uncaused, which is at variance with the dynamical law of the determination of all phenomena in time, or secondly, the series itself is without beginning, and although contingent and conditioned in all its parts, is nevertheless absolutely necessary and unconditioned as a whole, which is self-contradictory. For the existence of an aggregate cannot be necessary if no single part of it possesses necessary existence. Grant, on the other hand, that an absolutely necessary cause exists out of and apart from the world. This cause, as the highest member in the series of the causes of cosmical changes, must originate or begin, see footnote, the existence of the latter and their series. In this case, it must also begin to act, and its causality would therefore belong to time and consequently to the sum total of phenomena, that is, to the world. It follows that the cause cannot be out of the world, which is contradictory to the hypothesis. Therefore, neither in the world nor out of it, but in causal connection with it, does there exist any absolutely necessary being. Footnote. The word begin is taken in two senses. The first is active, the cause being regarded as beginning a series of conditions as its effect, infit. The second is passive, the causality in the cause itself beginning to operate, fit. I reason here from the first to the second. Observations on the fourth antinomy. On the thesis. To demonstrate the existence of a necessary being, I cannot be permitted in this place to employ any other than the cosmological argument, which ascends from the conditioned in phenomena to the unconditioned in conception, the unconditioned being considered the necessary condition of the absolute totality of the series. The proof, from the mere idea of a supreme being, belongs to another principle of reason, and requires separate discussion. The pure cosmological proof demonstrates the existence of a necessary being, but at the same time leaves it quite unsettled whether this being is of the world itself or quite distinct from it. To establish the truth of the latter view, principles are requisite which are not cosmological and do not proceed in the series of phenomena. We should require to introduce into our proof conceptions of contingent beings, regarded merely as objects of the understanding, and also a principle which enables us to connect these, by means of mere conceptions, with a necessary being. But the proper place for all such arguments is a transcendent philosophy which has unhappily not yet been established. But if we begin our proof cosmologically by laying at the foundation of it the series of phenomena and the regress in it according to empirical laws of causality, we are not at liberty to break off from this mode of demonstration and to pass over to something which is not itself a member of the series. The condition must be taken in exactly the same signification as the relation of the condition to its condition in the series has been taken, for the series must conduct us in an unbroken regress to this supreme condition. But if this relation is sensuous and belongs to the possible empirical employment of the understanding, the supreme condition or cause must close the regressive series according to the laws of sensibility, and consequently must belong to the series of time. It follows that this necessary existence must be regarded as the highest member of the cosmical series. Certain philosophers have nevertheless allowed themselves the liberty of making such a saltus, metabasis eis allogonos. From the changes in the world, they have concluded their empirical contingency, that is, their dependence on empirically determined causes, and they thus admitted an ascending series of empirical conditions. And in this they are quite right. But as they could not find in this series any primal beginning or any highest member, they passed suddenly from the empirical conception of contingency to the pure category, which presents us with a series, not sensuous but intellectual, whose completeness does certainly rest upon the existence of an absolutely necessary cause. Nay, more, this intellectual series is not tied to any sensuous conditions, and is therefore free from the condition of time, which requires it spontaneously to begin its causality in time. But such a procedure is perfectly inadmissible, as will be made plain from what follows. In the pure sense of the categories, that is contingent, the contradictory opposite of which is possible. Now, we cannot reason from empirical contingency to intellectual. The opposite of that which is changed, the opposite of its state, is actual at another time, and is therefore possible. Consequently, it is not the contradictory opposite of the former state. To be that, it is necessary that in the same time in which the preceding state existed, its opposite could have existed in its place. But such a cognition is not given us in the mere phenomenon of change. A body that was in motion, equals A, comes into a state of rest, equals non-A. Now, it cannot be concluded from the fact that a state opposite to the state A follows it that the contradictory opposite of A is possible, and that A is therefore contingent. To prove this, we should require to know that the state of rest could have existed in the very same time in which the motion took place. Now, we know nothing more than that the state of rest was actual in the time that followed the state of motion, consequently, that it was also possible. But motion at one time and rest at another time are not contradictorily opposed to each other. It follows from what has been said that the succession of opposite determinations, that is, change, does not demonstrate the fact of contingency as represented in the conceptions of the pure understanding, and that it cannot therefore conduct us to the fact of the existence of a necessary being. Change proves merely empirical contingency, that is to say, that the new state could not have existed without a cause which belongs to the preceding time. This cause, even though it is regarded as absolutely necessary, must be presented to us in time, and must belong to the series of phenomena. On the antithesis. The difficulties which meet us in our attempt to rise through the series of phenomena to the existence of an absolutely necessary supreme cause must not originate from our inability to establish the truth of our mere conceptions of the necessary existence of a thing. That is to say, our objections must not be ontological, but must be directed against the causal connection with a series of phenomena of a condition which is itself unconditioned. In one word, they must be cosmological and relate to empirical laws. We must show that the regress in the series of causes, in the world of sense, cannot conclude with an empirically unconditioned condition, and that the cosmological argument from the contingency of the cosmical state, a contingency alleged to arise from change, does not justify us in accepting a first cause, that is, a prime originator of the cosmical series. The reader will observe in this antinomy a very remarkable contrast. The very same grounds of proof which established in the thesis the existence of a supreme being demonstrated in the antithesis, and with equal strictness, the non-existence of such a being. We found, first, that a necessary being exists because the whole time past contains the series of all conditions, and with it, therefore, the unconditioned, the necessary. Secondly, that there does not exist any necessary being, for the same reason.